Hello there, and welcome back to Cooper Talks. And I'm going to be carrying on here looking at the build-up to the February Revolution that happened in Russia, of all places for the Russian Revolution of 1917 to begin. Yes, part of the Russia series, and this will, I'm sure, be very exciting. But picks up from the last episode, where we kind of setting the context for why revolution would break out in 1917. And what I'm going to look at today is the period of time between 1906 and the Tsar's recovery after the revolution of 1905, and how the Tsar and Russia as a whole responded to the new October Manifesto and the limitations that had been placed on the Tsar's power, and kind of what the situation was by the time we get to 1914 and the outbreak of World War One. And then in the next episode after this, I plan to look at the impact World War One had on exacerbating the problems and really trigger or building up to the trigger point of the February Revolution. So obviously, following on from the 1905 revolution, the Tsar has recovered power when the army comes back online, suppresses the Moscow Soviet, the St. Petersburg Soviet gives up. Number of key players like Lenin and Trotsky are in exile or in hiding, and the Tsar has recovered, but he only recovered because he had promised an October Manifesto, which allowed for, amongst other things, a Duma as well as various political freedoms. Now, what this meant, amongst other things, was that you had now a number of legal political parties, and I mentioned some of these last time, but it's worth just going over them. So if you think about the left-right-wing spectrum in politics, right-wing being more conservative, small-c conservative, kind of not favouring change, wanted to be very traditional and maintain the best elements of the past, to the left-wing, which in this sense wants extreme change to be brought about. The right-wing groups who are going to defend this kind of traditional way of life will be nationalists like the Black Hundreds, who want Russia to dominate all these other groups. OK, so the different nationalities and regions living in the Russia, and general conservatives, the All Russia Party, who oppose social change, very much supported by the nobility. They want to defend the status of the nobles and the elites, including the Tsar in society. Basically, almost ignore the October Manifesto and kind of keep it as it was. In the middle, you have these more moderate groups, centre-ground parties, and they wanted Russia to be a democracy. These were kind of the middle classes that the October Manifesto had tried to break away from the more radical left-wing groups. And so these two groups were the Octoberists, who supported the reforms of the October Manifesto and thought those reforms would bring better government and greater freedoms. And a group called the Cadets, spelt with a K, who were again a group of liberals who wanted political rights for all. They wanted constitutional monarchy, so they wanted limits on the Tsar's power. And they thought that the October Manifesto was a good starting point, but not the end point. But they certainly weren't in favour of getting rid of the Tsar or anything like that. On the far left, the more radical parties, these were people that wanted to challenge and even remove the Tsar and the wealthy nobility, and wanted to create some sort of wealth redistribution, taking from the rich to give to the poor. Various parties here, the Socialist Revolutionaries, sometimes known as the SRs, now they would argue amongst themselves. They wanted revolution, and the most radical would even support assassination attempts. And you also had a group called the Social Democrats. Again, they would also believe in revolution, kind of inspired by sort of Marxist ideology. They thought capitalism was the enemy, and they wanted to create a fairer society based on Karl Marx's teachings, which would be a communist society. This party, just a little future note here, this party of Social Democrats had actually split in two in 1903 when there'd been a bit of a vote. What they disagreed over, these two parties, were when a revolution should happen. So both of them supported the idea of a revolution, but Mensheviks, who were actually the majority at the time, the Mensheviks said, a revolution would happen eventually, and that they should work in the meantime to make things better for the workers, because Marx had said a revolution would begin in the most developed countries, and the revolution should happen organically, should happen naturally over time. And Russia just wasn't in a position at this stage. It hadn't even been middle class, so it couldn't have a revolution to become a communist state. The Bolsheviks said, no, we can trigger a revolution and start the revolution early on. And this is where Lenin would find his home. Bolshevik actually means minority, even though they quickly became the majority. Anyway, that's the Social Democrats. So you've got a whole mixture. And the key thing to remember is that many of these political parties had now become legal. They weren't allowed to exist. They'd been banned before the October Manifesto. But following the 1905 October Manifesto and the establishment of the first Duma in 1906, these parties are legally recognised, and they can claim the rights to free speech and free association to criticise the Tsar if they so wish and challenge what's going on in Russia. So, although it might not seem much, it was quite a big step forward. Now, a number of things will happen following on from 1906. The Tsar... let's start with the first Duma. Now, the Tsar's going to pick a guy called Stolypin. I'm not sure that's how you say it, but that's how I say it. Stolypin to be his first minister, kind of like a prime minister, I suppose we'd say, although that's a bit of an anachronism. And he would help the Tsar to reassert as much autocratic control as he could, despite the October Manifesto. Now, we see this first with the Duma. So Duma is this new parliament type thing that's being created. The first Duma is elected and meets in 1906, and it is dominated by that moderate group of the cadets. They're the ones. Now, that's partly because the left-wing groups refused to take part in the elections. They thought this was too much of a compromise. They didn't support the October Manifesto. And also a number of the right-wing groups didn't put any candidates forward because they thought it was beneath them. So it's dominated by the cadets, moderate reforming party. But it was quite clear early on that the Tsar and Stolypin were not going to allow them to have much their own way. They turn up with a sort of radical agenda for more democratisation. They wanted more rights and more freedoms and an extension on what had already been given. They wanted amnesty for people that had been involved in the violent actions of the revolution. They wanted greater land reform to give more access to land to the middle classes and to peasants. And they even wanted to be able to have a vote of censure, to be able to criticise the Tsar. And they also wanted to extend the power that the Dumas would have to challenge the legal propositions made by the Tsar. Now, the Tsar kind of shows his intention with the first meeting. When the members come in, they are deliberately placed facing the Tsar and his court and nobility to kind of show that they're confrontational, that they are the enemy and that he despises them. And within a few weeks, the Tsar had dissolved the first Duma without it achieving anything, kind of showing his point of view there. So then we have a second Duma, which occurs a couple of years later. Not a couple of years later in 1906, begins in 1907. This time, the Social Revolutionaries, Mensheviks and Bolsheviks all take part in the elections. So it is going to be a more open contest. The government actually now intervenes itself. So this is the Tsar intervenes and actually campaigns and funds supporters. So it funds the right-wing groups to try and manipulate the results. The cadets, as a result of this attack from both the right-wing, supported by the Tsar, and the left-wing candidates, they lose half their seats, and you end up with a new wave of radical leftists who are going to demand kind of not just the removal of some of the Tsar's power, but the removal of the Tsar and the whole concept of democracy and all those sorts of things as well. You're also going to have a new wave of ultra-nationalists as well as Octoberists who think there's been enough reforms, if not too many already. End result is that nothing's going to be achieved here. It's going to become an obstructionist body that really just can't do anything. So again, after a few weeks, the Tsar is going to dissolve it. So we have a situation with the first two Dumas where the Tsar has clearly decided he doesn't like the fact that this thing exists. He can't get rid of it, but he's going to make sure it has no power and treat it really, really badly. Now there will go on to be a third Duma, which I will come back to shortly. But for now, after the failures of these two Dumas, I didn't talk about the Vyborg Manifesto. Yeah, don't worry about that. I mean, one thing that happened between the first and second Duma was something called the Vyborg Manifesto, but that was really an attempt to start another revolution, but it didn't go anywhere, and that's what had weakened the cadets, amongst other things. Don't worry about that. But I'm going to talk now about Pierre Stolypin, as I call him. He was the one who really issued the dissolution of the second Duma, saying, too obstructionist, we need to get rid of it. Now, he will create two particular reforms to weaken the Duma and to assert control over the countryside, because although the army has been able to reimpose Tsarist control on the major cities, the countryside in 1906 and 1907 still has a lot of peasant discontent and uprisings going on, and Stolypin's going to be instrumental in reasserting the Tsar's control. So having dissolved the second Duma, he says, I know what we're going to do. I'm going to revise electoral law. So I'm going to fix it so that half the seats will be voted for by the nobility, on the assumption that the nobility will form the conservative and ultra parties that are going to support the Tsar and not allow for any future reform. So he says the nobility will have half the seats, and then all the other seats will be spread out amongst the peasants and the working class and the middle class. So it's really trying to make sure it's going to be nothing can get passed from this new Duma without the nobility supporting it. They will have the deciding vote. So, he's basically making sure the Duma has no power. He is very much against some of the things called fundamental laws that had tried to be brought in to try and further weaken the Tsar. And he didn't want the Duma to have any approval whatsoever, power over the Tsar. So he didn't want them to even have the power to be able to approve the Tsar's proposals. So it's very much a new traditional system that it's going to come against. And he is against the October Manifesto. So all his efforts are to try and undermine this. And we see the effects of this very much with the third Duma. Because when it comes in, it's a very conservative parliament, unsurprisingly. It will actually last for 5 years, from 1907 to 1912. Yes, members could be critical of the government, and they did pass some measures to do with the army and the navy, and even introduce some sort of accident insurance for workers. So there were some changes, but this is very much working within the existing system. It was not the radical pursuit for greater democracy that the revolutionaries in 1905 had hoped for, and it really just undermined the October Manifesto and all the changes that had been brought in. A fourth Duma would be elected on the same basis between 1912 and 1914, at which point World War One breaks out. The fourth Duma doesn't really achieve very much. So we get the sense the first two were kind of radical, but the Tsar gets rid of them, changes the voting system to make sure the third and fourth will be much more docile. Now, one of the problems they had during the third Duma was there was this guy called Alexander Guchikov, G-U-C-H-I-K-O-V. Again, don't worry too much about that. He was the leader of that moderate Octoberist party, so the one that thought there'd been enough reforms. He has a bit of a problem because he keeps winding up the Tsar and saying things, and the Tsar's very sensitive about this. So he keeps making these statements in the Duma, saying things like, there is no autocracy in Russia now. As far as the Tsar was concerned, there was. He was back in total control and power. He didn't like the existence of it at all. On top of this, he kept being critical about nepotism, which was rife in Russian society at the time, that the Tsar would appoint his favourites to key positions, particularly in the military, rather than people of merit. And the figure that will come to symbolise all of this more than anyone else is Rasputin. And I will come back to Rasputin. But these are the issues Guchikov keeps winding the Tsar up about. And the Tsar, he really hated Guchikov. So even though Guchikov was an Octoberist and a moderate person, the really the type of moderate person who thought the October Manifesto had gone far enough. As a leader of that party, Nicholas probably should have tried to work with him far more, but he personally couldn't stand him. Gutchakov kept winding him up, and so he refused to work with him, which does leave him with a very narrow band of supporters, basically the noble and the super wealthy. Thanks to Stolypin, they dominate the Dumas because of the electoral reforms, but they do not represent all of Russian society. And that's going to be really important when it gets to World War I, because it means the Tsar has no real support outside the nobility and the wealthy. Anyway, Nicholas II just hates the Duma, as we said. He even though the third and fourth Dumas were really conservative and basically like backed him, he refused to have anything to do with them. And he openly discussed removing all their powers and basically repealing the October Manifesto. It really kind of undermined everything that had been achieved in 1905. Now, while all this was going on, Stolypin, that man, between 1905 and 1914, he'd come with two sort of prongs, okay? The stick and carrot approach. On the stick, he introduced military tribunals and courts, and basically had lots of revolutionary peasants or peasants who were revolting. No, it's not funny. But he had them executed and murdered, so much so that the hangman's noose was nicknamed Stolypin's necktie. So it's absolutely brutal repression of anyone involved in revolting against the Tsarist rule. But at the same time, Stolypin accepted the need for land reform and to kind of create more food production in Russia, which he saw as essential to protect Russia from outside interventions as well as to keep the people happy. But also his hope was that if you gave some land to some of the peasants, they would take responsibility and work it for themselves. That would create more modern techniques and grow more crops. But they'd also take responsibility. You'd create a middle class, if you like, a class of lower landowners. We call them yeoman farmers in Britain. In Russia, they called them kulaks. So this would be landowning peasants who would take responsibility for the land. And Stolypin's idea was that this would create a kind of lower middle class group across the countryside that would basically help to keep and maintain order and prevent any future revolutions from happening. And in some ways, this did work. About 15% of peasants took him up on this offer, and the improvements did increase grain production in World War One. And who knows, if World War One hadn't happened, these reforms may have led to a strong and effective middle class that grew plenty of grain across the countryside. However, part of the issue was because they were making these reforms, and these reforms required bigger tracts of land, bigger sort of farming areas, a lot of the poorer peasants were forced to sell what little land they owned or possessed, and then forced to become labourers, and actually ended up in a worse position, basically having to go from kulak to kulak, selling the labour for jobs. So they'd lost the land that they used to use to feed themselves, and now they were basically, like urban workers in the cities, they were wage employees, and they had to rely on others for jobs. And that's going to create a lot of resentment towards the government that particular revolutionary groups will be able to exploit in the future. And it's also going to cause a lot of popular hostility to the kulaks, who were seen as the ones benefiting from this policy. And they did benefit, and that was the whole point. And as long as the Tsar remains in control, they will be in a good position. But that's a big if the Tsar remains in control. Big caveat there. Another side issue that backfires is peasants were encouraged, about 4 million of them in total, were encouraged to go and move from European Russia to along the Trans-Siberian Railway and set up new sort of farming colonies, kind of like in the American West, people settling along the new railways to try and begin agricultural developments in the east across Siberia. While they sold everything and set off along the Trans-Siberian Railway to do this, when they got to new settlements, new places, they found that the good land had already been taken by the rich and the nobility. And so there wasn't any land that they could farm there. They were either going to have to work as labourers, or, as many of them did, they returned back to where they come from, having sold all their possessions, feeling resentful towards the government policies. So we can see here that there were a number of reforms and attempts, but they really hadn't embedded by the time we get to 1914. And some of them have actually made a lot of peasants worse off and engendered resentment. This may not have been a problem had it not been for the introduction of World War I. At the same time, Stolypin and others are introducing changes in the cities. There's a big boost in steel production and other iron production across the major industrial cities. And Russia will quite rapidly go to become the fourth biggest producer of coal, pig iron and steel. The discovery of oil reserves in what is now Azerbaijan, around Baku, that's going to, and the Caspian region, that's going to lead to a huge increase in oil production, and Russia's going to get more money from that. And it's also going to lead, with the growth in this production, in the factories and so on, it's going to lead to a lot more urban workers, so people finding jobs. So that's going to be a big increase. And particularly in factories and manufacturing as well. So we're going to end up with about 2/5 of factory workers will be in factories by the time we get to World War One. This makes the factories more efficient and much better, but it also made it easier for the now legal trade unions to organise strikes and to hold these factories to ransom, or the owners to ransom, in the event of emergency. So it's powers to the workers, but it meant they could become more difficult and assert their rights more often. The other thing to remember is, while this new increased industrial production was good for Russia, economically speaking, it only really benefited the super wealthy, the owners of the means of production, the factory owners and the nobility and the czar and the taxation. Most of the workers actually didn't benefit. The working conditions really didn't improve at all. And in some cases, with more people, they actually got worse. And in real terms, average prices, prices had gone up so much that in real terms, even though wages did increase, workers were actually poorer than they had been before the 1905 revolution. So in a sense, there's this great economic boom, but it creates a poorer and more substantial urban working class in the major cities. And while the Tsar and others will be looking at the greater economic production and the manufacturing capabilities, which looks really good and should help them fight World War One, it's also creating a more volatile and resentful urban working class in the cities. That's going to mean another revolution, if one comes along, as we know it does, will have much more dire consequences than the one of 1905. So we see these changes coming through there. One particular example of this was a strike that took place in Siberia in 1912 called the Lena Goldfields. The Lena Goldfields were really, really badly run. The workers were not given safe accommodations. Lots of people died from accidents. There were low wages, and the working day lasted from about 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. So long, hard, physically demanding work with little pay. And they went on strike, as they were entitled to do, thanks to the October Manifesto. But they ended up clashing with troops, and 170 workers were killed, with another almost 400 wounded. And this was known as the Lena Goldfield Massacre. And in some ways, it was similar to the Bloody Sunday events in 1905, which caused a lot of workers' protests. But these protests were, with the army back online, they were dealt with brutally. And again, this is going to further alienate the working class in the cities from the Tsar and the Tsarist regime. Not a lot they can do while the Okhrana, the nobility and everything else is remaining on course. However, World War One is going to change that. And that's why World War One really is so important. Some things are improving, and maybe if they'd been given 100 years to bed in, that might have saved the Tsarist regime. That's a big maybe and if. but the Tsar's attempts to undermine the political advances and really rolling back the clock and trying to assert autocracy and pretend nothing had happened is just going to further alienate the workers in both the cities and the countryside. And the reforms that have happened, while they may have been good for Russia as economically and made it more competitive with the rest of Europe and America, it had created a larger and more unhappy working class across Russia. And that's going to have really, really dire consequences if the Tsar loses some sense of control. And that will happen in 1917. Now, the last thing just to talk about here is Rasputin. Now, Rasputin is one of those people that is big, huge in mythology, but in essence, he's not really that important. He's more important as a symbol than anything else. We might talk about him more during World War One because that's when it matters. But in a nutshell, the Tsar, his firstborn son, the heir, not the Dauphin, that's French. But anyway, the heir, Alexievich, was born with haemophilia. So basically, his blood wouldn't clot. So really dangerous. If he got any sort of cut or wound, he'd just bleed and bleed and bleed. So it was a really dangerous illness. He was very sickly and quite often would have, you know, huge swellings from the blood and so on. Medicine at the time was not doing anything to help him, and the Tsar, and particularly the Tsarina, were desperate for help. Now, there come rumours that there's this holy man from Siberia called Grigor Rasputin. He was a monk, but he's travelling around. There's all sorts of myths and rumours about him. Kind of preached a sort of poverty, claimed to have holy powers that gave him magical powers for healing. And he ends up, and also took part in sort of big sexual orgy, religious ceremonies that were supposed to give him power and stuff like that. The truth and the fiction is all very mixed up around Rasputin. He ends up, though, what we do know, he ends up at the court. And whether it's psychosomatic and a kind of placebo effect or not, we just will never know. But he would say prayers and that seemed to heal little Alexievich. And he seemed to do better, and that led to the Tsarina kind of keeping Rasputin on call and sort of rewarding him and giving him a higher social status in St. Petersburg. Now, in truth, it's very unlikely that the Tsarina did actually have an affair with Rasputin. That's a popular kind of myth. It's also very unlikely that he actually had any sort of say or direct influence over the Tsar. But people believed that he did. And that's the really key thing here. It kind of fed into the idea of the Tsar being weak and being manipulated by people that were kind of not putting Russia's interests to the forefront. There's the Tsarina, who, despite her efforts, is still regarded very much as a German outsider, manipulating and influencing the Tsar in a negative way. And then there's Rasputin, who's around a lot and creating a lot of hostility from the nobles. They feel he's got too privileged a place. So whatever the truth of what Rasputin did, in a sense, doesn't matter. His presence at the court and his favoured position with the Tsar and Tsarina meant that people saw him as an evil presence that was manipulating a very weak and ineffectual Tsar. And that feeds into the impression of the Tsar being an incapable ruler and these evil forces manipulating him. Now, this will particularly be important during World War One, because towards the end of it, the Tsar will go off to the front. And I'll talk about this more next time. And he'll leave the Tsarina in charge. And the belief is that her and Rasputin are really running the country. Rasputin was never actually put in control of the country, but people believed his influence over the Tsarina led to lots of awful decisions that caused greater suffering in Russia. And that led to the assassination of Rasputin. And again, that goes down into legend. I'll give you a quick summary here because it's a great story. So legend goes, at the Yusupov Palace, Prince Yusupov, lots of palaces in St. Petersburg, but Prince Yusupov and some other conspirators plotted to get Rasputin to basically assassinate him. And they invited him round, and Prince Yusupov's sat and he's got some almond cakes. Rasputin's meant to love almond cakes. And almonds, well, the scent, what is it? Cyanide. Cyanide is apparently meant to smell like almonds, so it disguised the taste of almonds. And Rasputin apparently just sat there eating loads of these cakes, and Yusupov's a bit worried. He goes, I've eaten quite a few, and he seems to still be alive. And he's a bit worried because estimates are that, you know, Rasputin had eaten enough to basically kill an entire garrison, and he was like, well, wasn't he dead yet? So he goes off to his other conspirators, who I'm not sure where they were. They were somewhere in the palace. In my mind, they were like hiding behind a curtain, but that's not true. Anyway, he goes, he's not dying, he's not dead. And they said, well, you'll have to shoot him then. And so he comes back into the room and he says, Rasputin, I'm going to shoot you because you're such a bad man. And so he shoots him, and Rasputin falls down dead. And he goes, phew, it's done now. Goes off, says to the conspirators, it's all right, I've shot him now. And then they go back in to just check the body, and the body's gone. They go, where's he gone? And they look out the window, and it's kind of a cold, cold night in St. Petersburg. And Rasputin's kind of hobbling across the courtyard because he somehow, despite having all this cyanide and being shot at kind of point-blank range, he's managed to get up, climb down the outside of the building. He's sort of trying to limp away across the courtyard. So then they go chasing after him. And they then shove him through a hole in the ice because lots of canals in St. Petersburg. So they shoved him through a hole in the ice. And figured that'd be it, he'd be drowned. And his body was found a few days later, he was dead. But turned out he hadn't drowned. So somehow he'd survived and died of hypothermia. There was no water in his lungs. I mean, it was very cold, so maybe the hypothermia took him. But again, the kind of story of his death, and the conspirators all kind of clammed up and kept it quiet, because technically that was murder, you know, and even if they were nobles, they could have got into trouble. That's fed into this whole myth of Rasputin, and people have seen him, you know, as a magic man, as some kind of evil sorcerer, manipulator. The truth is, he was regarded as a holy man. He did do some sort of confidence trickery thing that at least made the prince feel that he was slightly better. The Tsarevich, I think that's the name for the next in line. But yeah, they done something and he convinced the Tsarina, and he certainly did get a favoured position. And he was, the ladies of St. Petersburg did apparently find him quite interesting, though how much he actually had these debauched affairs, we don't know. But it all feeds in to a Tsar who is out of touch and who's seen as weak and is alienating his public. So, by 1914, what have we got to? In a sense, autocracy and direct rule by the monarch had been reintroduced. Okay, the fundamental laws, these new laws have been introduced that basically said there were certain things, and most areas, the Tsar had the absolute power to do whatever he liked, and the Duma couldn't interfere with them. So in a sense, they undermined the October Manifesto. The Dumas were weak and puppets. And there really was no rule of law. As Stolypin approved with his necktie, people were just accused of treason and executed in the countryside without any sort of due process or legal restrictions. So in a sense, it was still absolutist control by the Tsar. However, crucially, the very fact there was an existence of a Duma and the very fact that there were elections meant that there wasn't full autocracy. The Tsar had received some limitations. There were a number of established political parties. Some of them had been banned because they refused to be part of the Dumas and so on and had got into trouble for criticising the Tsar. And there had been reforms to try and create a peasant middle class and grow more food and to improve the economic output. In essence, despite these changes, Russia, in a sense, by 1914, had returned to a pretty autocratic system. The Tsar was basically in full control over everything. And although he'd seen these economic advances, in many ways, the system he'd overseen had actually created more workers and more disgruntled peasants, and shown that he was not prepared to accept any reform. So he turned the clock back rather than embracing the reforms of the October Manifesto. And that means if a crisis comes along again and he doesn't have his five key things, including the army, to keep control, the people are not going to trust him and not going to be prepared to work with him. And that's what we're going to see in World War One. We're going to see a crisis breakout that is going to be beyond the Tsar's capability. It's going to lead to much greater hardship in Russia and eventually the complete and utter collapse of the army, at which point it's going to be very easy for the political parties that are in existence to seize control through the Duma and exert their control. And that's really where the February Revolution is going to be. So in a sense, the period 1906 to 1914 could have been an attempt for the Tsar to find a way of working for the long-term security of his reign and Russia. He ignored that and tried to wind the clock back. And really that might have worked had it not been for World War One. But all it actually did was just build up the resentment and the alienation. And we're going to see how World War One ends up triggering the February Revolution in the next episode. So yeah, about 36 minutes, slightly on the longer side for this one, but I hope this context and background is useful in understanding why the first revolution broke out. World War One and the February Revolution next time. Hope this is useful and gives you some interesting background. And if there's anything you'd like me to do, please do let me know. Send me a message or leave a comment in the chats. Otherwise, take care and I will speak to you next time. Goodbye.